So I'd like to introduce our first speaker, Sue Mulvern, who has published extensively on war and visual representation, feminism and contemporary art. She's the author of Modern Art, Britain and the Great War, published in 2004. And recent essays include On the Troublesome Relationship of Feminism and Terrorism, Representing the Female Terrorist in Contemporary Art. She also recently co-organised a project called Terrorist Transgressions and is co-editing a collection of papers for IB Taurus on this subject. Today she's going to be talking to us on witnessing and testimony. Thank you, Sue.
Thank you. I have to say this paper has had rather a lot of manifestations. That's it, got it. So I've kind of, it's an ongoing work in progress, but it sometimes staggered me how long it's been in progress. But I first gave it because I was part of this project at the Presentation House Gallery in Vancouver in 1999, which included a section called Bearing Witness. We had an uncomfortable private view because Kosovo was happening. Then subsequently, Francisco Manacorda did a project at the Mead Gallery in 2004 called Mythological Machine, which was about responses to 9/11. And I spoke then also on how visual responses to war work. My point is that I'm going to range quite widely, largely on the First World War, but I want to look quite extensively also at the whole question of witnessing throughout 20th and 21st century, in part because World War I, it seems to me, has inflected how we view more recent wars, and vice versa, contemporary conflicts have also refracted how we consider and reflect on the First World War. My second sort of introductory mark is that I've spent an enormous amount of my career, it seems, as an academic and an art historian, researching official war artists. I'm horrified to recall that I did my PhD on this in 1980. But I think my complaint is that the possibly is that it's, if only we could think through these issues outside moments of crisis or whenever we're involved in commemoration, we might move the debate, which seems to me to be painful and difficult debates about war and art. But a lot of my work, as I guess many of you know, has been on the employment of official war artists. And in Britain, we've got a tradition for this which has persisted. So the last few years, we've also had official war artists in the Gulf War in Bosnia and Afghanistan. And the purpose of employing war artists by governments have been quite complex. Some motivations have been honourable. For example, governments have sometimes used artists in order to prevent them from being called up to fight, so making being an artist or a war artist specifically into an essential reserved occupation. But governments have also wanted to demonstrate, especially in total wars such as the First World War, with which we're concerned, that the nation is so committed that it has mobilised its cultural capital by using its artists in its campaign against an enemy. So, of course, artists have been used in official propaganda. And here is an extremely well-known example, the front cover of a publication called British Artists at the Front in 1918. And although the cover says the publishers are Country Life, of course they weren't. The book was produced and circulated by a government propaganda agency called Wellington House, who borrowed the imprint of Country Life partly in order to disguise their involvement, but also to give the publication more credibility. What comes as a surprise, I think, to quite a lot of audiences is not only is this book dedicated to the war art of a very well-known, almost paradigmatic English war artist, Paul Nash, reproduced on the cover of the publication is a painting we now take as a paradigm, as an anti-war image. We are making a new world. We think of it as quintessential anti-war, an authentic image, because it depicts a devastated landscape, recognisably the front line in France. It is empty and barren, depicted at sunrise, with sun rays breaking over the clouds, which are suffused in blood red. Broken trees stand like metaphors for the war dead. I introduce this work because I want to show just how paradoxical artists' relationship to depicting war is, as well as to suggest that official employment should never be reduced to sort of boiled down account of artists must somehow be manipulated by suggesting that the whole use of artists in the way in which we construct and represent wars and how we argue our participation in wars is very, very complex and much more complex than we'd expect. So here is another 1918 image. It's a page spread from an illustrated magazine of the period called The Graphic, and it's titled The Trench from Different Points of View or The Battle of the War Artist. It's subtitled right at the bottom of the page, which you can't possibly read, The Methods of Illustrating the War, a little account of the variety of viewpoints. The Graphic was a completely conservative paper, entirely pro-war, but this page was reproduced to illustrate a complaint, and their complaint was that the government had taken control of war imagery. The top three pictures are official photographs, which are telling what the paper, the Graphic says, are the plain, unvarnished tale of the photograph. In the middle is a painting by an academic artist, now forgotten, quite possibly well forgotten, called James P. Beagle. The work is titled Dawn Waiting to Go Over. So there it is again. The paper called this picture a typical illustration. And then at the bottom are two images by Paul Nash on the left, which has survived, and by another young artist, who I'm sure is going to feature today, C.R.W. Nevinson. What is paradoxical about the page in the Graphic is that both Nash and Nevinson are official artists, and what the newspaper is complaining about is that these official artists are modernist artists, chosen from what the paper calls esoteric schools, those whose work, it says, appeals mainly to art connoisseurs. So it seems to be the case in the First World War in Britain, at least. It seems that when governments seek to control visual imagery, it is modern avant-garde artists, those whose work is usually assumed to be oppositional and critical, who become the government's representatives in how the war will be represented and then, of course, eventually remembered. Maybe we'll come back to that one. Part of the reason why artists such as Paul Nash and C.R.W. Nevinson came to be recruited as official artists is that they were soldier artists. By the 1916-17, about the point when they start to paint on behalf of the government, the First World War had come to seem completely unknowable except by those who'd actually served in it. Both Nevinson and Nash had served at the front in Nevinson's case in rather complex ways. And if their work seemed modern, even incomprehensible, what the Graphic called esoteric, then this was a consequence of being witnesses to something without precedent in the life of the nation. In this case, the artist has been granted a special privilege that warrants the authenticity of what he, and it is very rarely she, depicts. It is a notion that persists. John Keane, for example, Britain's official artist in the First Gulf War, was prevented from publishing a war diary in The Guardian, who had heroically sponsored his life insurance, because the Ministry of Defence argued that he'd been given facilities denied journalists, presumably because his status assumed an artist's sense of discretion. The term war art seems to bring together two notions usually held to be in opposition, war and art, and these contradictions have been extensively observed by artists who are attempting to represent the war. And here are three artists describing what they have witnessed in three different conflicts, the First and Second World Wars and then Bosnia, the point being that the recurrence of this dilemma interests me. They're also all official war artists employed by the government on behalf of the nation, although in this case none have been a combatant. The first one is William Rothenstein, sent to France in January 1918. A Rothenstein painting. He writes, "Had I asked myself, would I rather there had been no war and consequently no such strange, livid beauty, I should have been at a loss how to answer." The second is by Mary Cassell, a wonderful artist, an official artist making work after the liberation of Bergen-Belsen in April 1945. These are three entries from her diary written August and September of that year. Of Belsen, she writes, "It's vast and quite wonderful, what paintings and drawings. Berlin, however, smells of death, incredible, like a million-year-old ruin standing silent, so that crickets sing and one can hear them, and pale figures creeping around cutting trees, hidden in the dark. Oh, unforgettable smell of thousands of dead. Berlin is so beautiful and I can't do anything about it." And she goes on, No one in London knows what bombing is, and all poets and artists and thinkers should come and see it for themselves. It's so movingly beautiful, no words can describe it. The last is by Peter Howson, who was sent to Bosnia in 1994, and he writes, "Half of you detests what you see, and half of you wants to be there. You're living on the edge, and it's exciting, that's the truth of the matter. You don't understand how incredible it is, you don't have a clue. It could really be a life's work." So all three of these artists in these three different wars name something of the compelling beauty of war, which makes the matter of picturing it urgent, a task to be undertaken almost with a sense of mission. But this mission is marked with a feeling for a boundary or limit on representation, that there's something ultimately incommunicable and therefore unknowable about the sites. This is why Cassell mentions the need to come and see it for yourself, and like Howson, she's afraid that what she makes will be misunderstood. Moreover, all of the artists are troubled by matters of propriety, not only about whether the terms war and beauty can justifiably be brought into juxtaposition, but also about the decorum of even making work about war. The sites produce a wealth of resources for artists, and this raises the question of profiting from war or preying on the suffering of others. It's a matter for these artists of giving testimony to something witnessed, but the war artist is not a war correspondent nor a photojournalist, and the artist's evidence does not serve the same purpose. There is no question, as there is for the journalists, that there ought to be a close match between what's seen and how it's reported. It is precisely the artist's invention and inventiveness that is valued. For the official artist, however, such art must not seem contingent. Somehow it must transcend its moment to transmute horror and suffering into remembrance. In some ways, these official artists' works are meant to be redemptive acts of restitution for what are perceived to be injustices. Of course, governments who invest in assumptions about artists' authenticity and ethical integrity aspire to commission works that will legitimate war retrospectively and endow their own participation with lasting honour and significance. All modern governments promote wars as defensive interventions against injustice. But it's the way of these things that, that investing in official artists is to take the risk that what artists produce generates an excess of meanings impossible to contradict or control. This puts commissioned war artists under enormous pressure. There's a burden to be borne about witnessing, even a sense of shame. This sense of shame, however, this burden, is one that is also borne by the war correspondents. Here is Michael Hare writing in Dispatches about the Vietnam War. He recalls seeing his first war photographs in Life magazine. And he writes, "You know how it is, you want to look and you don't want to look. Even when the picture was sharp and defined, something wasn't clear at all. Something repressed that monitored the images and withheld their essential information. I remember now the shame I felt like looking at porn. It took the war to teach it that you are responsible for everything you saw as you were for everything you did." This kind of sense of shame, I think, is also just as forcibly voiced after the 9/11 attacks. So here's Thomas Hoepke, the photographer. "There was such a contradiction, we've heard it, Rothenstein precisely in the First World War, in the beauty of the day and the real horror downtown." He goes on, "Magnum was founded as a group of documentary photographers. That is our tradition. I strongly believe in documentary photography, in taking pictures of real life. Its purpose is to bear witness." Of course, the whole problem of witnessing and decorum has been rehearsed particularly acutely around the Holocaust. And the famous kind of taking up of this is Adorno, who writes about Paul Celan, who wrote a poem called Todd's Fugues, that his poetry is permeated by a sense of shame stemming from the fact that artists are unable either to experience or sublimate suffering. In 1949, Adorno famously wrote that to write poetry after Auschwitz is barbaric, a statement which is often miscited and completely misunderstood, but which he reaffirmed in 1962, reviewing Jean-Paul Sartre's essay, What is Literature? For Sartre, the lesson of the occupation of the Shoah was that evil is absolute and cannot be redeemed. He called it a horrible, irreducible beauty. Adorno's point about reiterating his interdiction, writing poetry after the Holocaust, in the light of Sartre's committed literature, was that it expresses the paradox of art forced to remember because suffering tolerates no forgetting, and only in art would suffering find a voice that would not betray it. But art was also prohibited from representing that anguish. Turning suffering into an image was to use victims to create a work of art to be returned for consumption by a world which had destroyed them. So one had to avoid this notion that of making the unthinkable appear to have some meaning, transfiguring, reducing something of its horror. Any representation of physical pain, has the power to elicit enjoyment at the sight of that pain. This is then taken up again by Leo Bassani, who talks about the way in which sympathetic responses to sights of suffering always risk pleasure or a sort of sadomasochistic enjoyment. And he talks about how they disturb our psychic equilibrium. And I think in part this explains the sense of shame and the burden of responsibility felt by the war artists, both towards the subject observed and towards the publics imagined and summoned as witnesses to the work that they've made. The issue, however, is not to ban representations nor to put art under some impossible paradoxical interdiction. Rather, it is a matter of how to produce representations which have a non-mimetic relationship to violence and which frustrate, impede, or divert the viewer's imitative impulse. It becomes a question, then, of how artists as witnesses to suffering negotiate representations to audiences. The First World War privileged first-person evidence in war art, but also in other cultural forms such as war poems and war narratives. In the contemporary world, the media fulfills the role of first-person witnessing, being on the spot, at the front, relaying, as it happens, images to the home. But the testimony of participants can make the evidence of those who have witnessed at first hand coercive, particularly so when the narrator is also a veteran. Questioning such evidence then becomes an act of disloyalty. Instead, the viewer is recruited as a made-to-order witness, subpoenaed to testify to the authority of those presumed to know, the war veteran, the war reporter. And the made-to-order witness is a term invented by Hitchcock, the filmmaker. This made-to-order witness stays at home and does not fight, and in the First World War this meant those too old, too young, or incapacitated, or those whose masculinity is disabled, distrusted, or otherwise incomplete, and of course the largest category of the made-to-order witness, women. In relation to events after 9/11, we've all become made-to-order witnesses. The gaze of the more made-to-order witness will always be a feminine gaze, one that signifies lack. And I want to end up to my last points are about this femininity, or I'm trying to gender the question of witnessing. Mary Kelly, there's some images of 9/11. Mary Kelly made a comment on a piece she made about the First Gulf War called Gloria Patri, that she wanted to negotiate a position for the viewer in between the only two spaces apparently allowed for identification when viewing images of suffering in war. On the one hand, there is a historical over-identification with victims. On the other, there is a projection of victims as other in the realm of the abject. She observed, correctly I think, that as far as registering the trauma of being a witness to suffering, psychically it doesn't matter whether we witness this directly or so through the so-called filtering effects of the media. Registering the trauma has the same impact whether or not it's vicarious or in the presence of the so-called real event. And of course, the paradigm of an image which we celebrate because it does precisely this, registered a trauma of suffering in an event that the artist didn't witness but showed, viewed entirely through the media, is Picasso's Guernica, 1937, that she painted entirely from photographs and reportage after the bombing of the town of Guernica. A consequence of making no difference whether trauma is witnessed directly or as a media representation is that it is possible to be implicated in something happening elsewhere and therefore to have a voice. It's therefore a matter of considering how agency might be attributed to a feminine gaze, reconceived as a resisting gaze, which refuses to accede to the subordinate position prescribed to it. And so I want to look at the differential position of women and the feminine gaze in relationship to war art and then try and draw some conclusions about the non-participating witnesses to other people's war evidence, which is in the 21st century and the 100th anniversary of the First World War, precisely what we've all become, because there are no living witnesses to the First World War. At Mythological Machine, one of the line drawings exhibited was by Cesare Vieille, was a depiction of the well-known feminist writer Virginia Woolf, of course, whose anti-war tracts were shaped in the First World War. And to this, Vieille has added a handwritten text in Italian, and it says, Virginia Woolf, looking at the newspaper images of the Chechen kamikazes killed in Moscow in October 2002. In 1938, as you know, Virginia Woolf wrote an anti-war tract, Three Guineas, in which she analysed the limitations of citizenship for women within the patriarchal state, and she proposed a secret organisation called the Outsider Society. As is well known, as Woolf wrote Three Guineas, she had photographs of women and children killed in the Spanish Civil War before her, which were being circulated by the Spanish government to generate support for the Republican cause. Her text was an answer to the question, what can women contribute to the prevention of war? And her answer was the Outsider Society, and she goes on, because as a woman I have no country, as a woman I want no country, as a woman my country is the whole world. And if you're tuned into the rhetoric of the First World War, you'll immediately recognise the statements of Edith Cavell on Edith Cavell's memorial, patriotism is not enough. I began by showing you artist's work from the First World War that made very problematic the distinction between artists and media representations. In the First World War, the media was dependent almost entirely on still photographs. Moreover, in Britain, access to any of the fronts for journalists and photographers was severely curtailed. Using artists was critical in World War I for the control of representation and for controlling how images circulated in the public domain, whatever the limitations of the control that was operated and with whatever qualifications of success the government had in achieving this. In the immediate aftermath of 9/11, Susan Buck-Morse wrote that 9/11 signified was the emergence of a global audience for war events. Unlike earlier wars, media imagery can no longer be systematically targeted at specific audiences, and that collapses the distinction between them and us. As a consequence, state agencies, she argues, can no longer exert control over propaganda. She wrote that the media no longer reports wars because it is inextricably entangled within it. The mass media is now a deterritorialized weapon that both harms and protects. In Mythological Machine, Raina Ganil included embroideries from his series Afghan Dialogues that might be thought about as figuring a feminine gaze which is reconceived as resisting. He's remarked that he began the work when Afghanistan was being bombed in recollection of embroidered works by Alighiero Boetti that he had begun in the 70s, travelling frequently to Kabul. Boetti employed weavers to make maps and rugs to his designs, into which the weavers, usually women, added their own inscriptions, usually in Pashto. Raina Ganil sent texts that he collected from American television news broadcast to Peshawar, where they were embroidered, with an instruction to each embroider to add their own comment. Being written in Pashto, these are unavailable to Western audiences unless you're given a translation, and I can't translate that one. And I think I can't get that one. I got some of them. They say things like the America should think more carefully about bombing Afghanistan, or the G8 should give careful thought to their decisions. But the point is, not only does this work restore agency to the alien other, giving him or her a voice and a presence, it also reinscribes the social and geographical distances that a deterritorialized media has collapsed. Ganil also refers to these works as renegotiated history paintings. So Afghan Dialogues attempts to remake history painting into narratives that give a voice to the feminist or other, but who speaks in ways that specifically do not instruct or proselytize, so we can't read these. This is my last image, by a woman photographer made in 1981 of the classic image of the aftermath of the Western Front. Michael Rothberg has shown how readings of Adorno's claim that we can't write poetry after Auschwitz have been dominated by a judgmental stance towards works of art and their makers. somehow we think we can moralise about arts decorum in relationship to what is represented on the basis of the principles we think and hear in an event. For example, the enormity and irreducibility of the Holocaust, or the enormity of the male death rate in the First World War. And he asks, how would it be if instead of judging artists, we recognised our own very ambiguous distance from the event and inquired into the relationship that a work establishes between the past it mobilises and its contemporary context? Works of art which deal with impossible subjects, such as the slaughter on the Western Front, might therefore be thought about less for whether or not they are adequate for the various insights we think they ought to give us, and much more in terms of the nature of the interventions they make for shifting audiences and different contexts. It is a question of how we, the audiences for war art, respond so as to recognise that we are responsible for everything we see, just as we are for everything we do. Thank you.